Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Connor Boyack. Connor is one of the creators of a very popular children's stories series, The Tuttle Twins. It is very popular in my household. I read it to my kids almost every night. I mean, well, we do read some other books. It's not just all libertarian propaganda in my household, although it comes close. But these books are pretty great. They've sold more than 5 million copies worldwide, an enormous achievement. And it's at the time when, you know, most children's materials these days contains all kinds of nefarious propaganda. Connor is serving up the world with some of the healthy, wholesome, pro-freedom, pro-liberty propaganda that we'd love to see. Connor, it's a pleasure to have you here.
That was a great introduction. I like how you used the word propaganda like 18 times, so I'm excited.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good to own this term because we're surrounded by propaganda all around us, and that there's this idea that if you're, you know, as long as you're promoting pro-government agenda, then it's science and it's expert right. opinion.
Whereas if I used to actually get defensive when people would say that the Tuttle Twins is propaganda in early years when the critics would say that, and in the past few years, I've embraced the term, as you said, trying to reclaim it. In part because I realized that everything is propaganda. The word propaganda just really means the propagation of information. And we typically use it in a negative sense, like when an adult is trying to, like, you know, brainwash a child without them, you know, having critical thinking or anything. But I realized that, like, no matter what a teacher is teaching or what's in a textbook or what they hear on TikTok or what parents say, it's all propaganda. So ultimately, the question is, do we want to not, you know, influence kids and their parents with our ideas, or do we want to compete for their minds and hearts and loyalty and affection? And I think we ought to be competing. So that's kind of the basis of what we're doing with the Teletwins.
Yeah, I think a part of this is just this, using the term as a slur indicates that there's this sort of healthy, correct tabula rasa of slavery mm-hmm. to government, which needs to be taught to students and children from an early age, and that anything that is subversive from this is, in a sense, nefarious and propaganda, whereas the reality is children are born as a tabula rasa, and everything that they're going to be subjected to is somebody trying to influence them. And it's I think as a parent, you need to embrace that. You know, you are out there competing against TV, against all the media that they consume, against the advertisements that they see, against all kinds of things in their schools. And it's up to you to try and influence them with the ideas that you want. And I think you guys do a great job with that.
Well, we certainly have fun along the way. And honestly, like, the surprising thing for me when we started was I thought we were just creating children's books and, hey, let's teach kids about, you know, libertarian ideas or Austrian economics. And we did, and we were. But what I didn't realize we were also doing was teaching the parents. So over half of the parents who get our books tell us that they're learning new things that they've never learned before, right? Because the schools aren't teaching this. They haven't taught this stuff in decades, if not longer. And so the parents grow up, and if they do have a more liberty-minded worldview, or if they do understand some of these economic principles, they don't understand them even well enough to then simplify and explain them to their child. They think, oh, well, I'll wait till they turn 18, you know, and then they're a voter, we'll talk about these things. Or when they're a teenager and they get a job, then we'll talk about it. And they never do. That day never comes. And by then, the child's been exposed to years of kind of leftist, socialist, statist propaganda, and have already started to become set in this worldview that is quite different than what the parents wanted. So really what we're trying to do is empower parents to have a shared language with their younger children through which they can talk about how the world works, how, you know, people behave, human action. Why are these things happening the way that they do? And by giving them that shared language, mom or dad, they can be teaching during the informal moments, right? They're driving to soccer and they hear something on the radio about maybe inflation. And the kid in the backseat's like, oh, that's just like in the creature from Jekyll Island. And they can have like a 5-minute conversation about it because there's that reference point that both child and parent have. And so really what we're after is like family discussions and creating more like dinner table conversation moments where if the parents know what the kids are reading and they have that common language, they can have more meaningful conversations as the kids get older. And then hopefully we can rescue them from the seductive, the siren song of socialism that they're hearing everywhere else.
Yeah, I agree entirely because, I mean, my job is to communicate those ideas. I write books about them. I do podcasts and I'm on Twitter communicating economics and libertarian ideas all the time. And yet it was very difficult for me to think about how can I communicate these to my kids. I mean, it's really difficult. And I remember being a little bit skeptical when I first heard about the Tuttle twins. I thought, how are you going to explain, you know, Mises and Hayek and break it down to a 7-year-old? I don't think that's going to work. I still bought them, you know, I thought I'll get them. And I was, because personally, I wasn't able to communicate those ideas in a way that I thought my kids could grasp. And yet, you guys do such a terrific job of breaking them down, simplifying them, putting them in the context of stories that are understandable and relevant to the children. So whether it's the golden rule or central banking or the road to serfdom or all these enormously complex ideas, which, you know, for the vast majority of us who are familiar with it, we've learned that by reading hundreds of pages of dense Austrian economics and going on very, very long thought experiments with Rothbard and Mises and Hayek. And it's just, it doesn't fit into a 7-year-old's world in our mind, but you guys do such a terrific job about it.
Let me ask you a kind of a question, or let's do a little thought experiment there just to put an exclamation point on it. Let's say you're on the side of the road, people are walking by and you stop an individual. Let's say it's a 40-year-old, you know, middle-aged gentleman, and you have a copy of Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt with you. Fantastic book, right? Or Human Action or any of these like classic economic texts. And you say, hey, this is a really important book that will help you understand what's going on in our society today and in the economy. You should read it. It's going to empower you. It's going to help you know how better to manage your money and your resources. What would you guess would be the percentage of individuals in that type of example who would actually read that book that you give them?
Less than 10%, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say less than 1%. Maybe I'm being overly skeptical, right? Probably the percentage would be higher if you give them, you know, Bitcoin Standard or one of your books that simplify things, because the books that were written decades ago by these economists, the words have multiple syllables, right? There's no pictures. This is very kind of dry English. By contrast, if you stop that same individual, let's say he's got two kids at home, and you say, hey, I've got this book about entrepreneurship or about money or about the golden rule or about, you know, peace and prosperity. And would you like to read this with your kids to teach them these concepts? Do you think it's important for your kids to learn these concepts? And I think like 99% of parents would say, yes, I want my children to have access to that information. I want them to be well-rounded. I want them to be critical thinkers. I want them to understand how the world works that they're growing up to be a part of. And so what we found is that children's books are kind of this, I don't know, like subtle, devious way to get at the adults as well, because their defenses come down, right? If you hand them economics in one lesson, their defenses go up. They're like, no, I don't need that. You know, I don't read books. I just watch YouTube shorts and TikTok, right? And so their defenses come up and they don't engage. But if you empower them to help their children, their defenses come down, they read alongside their child. And then as we're seeing with our community, over half of them are learning new things themselves because they're willing to be exposed to those new ideas. Their kids are asking them questions about what they're reading. The parents are having to like think through this and figure out what's going on. And so I think both with books like yours that simplify things, I would say, from a lot of the economists of decades past, when I even read those and I'm like, oh, my head hurts. I need to like pause after three pages and come back to this tomorrow, right? So efforts like yours, but then a step further in doing children's books, I think the more we simplify, the broader the message goes. And that's kind of the principle behind what we're doing, is simplify and spread so that we can get the greatest penetration possible.
I agree entirely. I'd add one perhaps criticism, and I hope I don't get excommunicated by the Internet Austrians for this, but one criticism I have of the writings of Rothbard and Mises is that they were writing at a time when they were outside of the mainstream and they were considered cranks, essentially. And so for them, they were still trying to argue with the mainstream. They were still trying to argue with Harvard professors and convince the Harvard professors that no, actually socialism is wrong. And here's why all of your thousands of pages of diarrhea are meaningless economics. And, you know, and like, it's admirable on one sense that they went through all of this socialist garbage literature and refuted it very thoroughly. But it's not exactly the most efficient way of communicating those ideas to somebody who's not interested in mid-20th century academic fights. And so yeah. the drawback to reading Man, Economy, and State or Human Action is just how much in there is going to try and refute some utterly forgotten and inconsequential socialist professor that you'll never hear about any time anywhere these days. But back in the 50s or 60s or 40s, they were, you know, so the big shot at Harvard, and their books were considered important. Of course, nobody reads about them today. Their work is gone. You know, their work is essentially government propaganda that served its purpose back then to justify government policies back then. And Mises and Rothbard and a lot of these economists were writing to try and convince those, to try and argue with them, to try and convince the world that those guys are not correct, that this is the best way of doing it. Mm-hmm. And that just takes up a lot of time. And I find it not very conducive towards reaching the normal person. And it's not, I don't see it as dumbing down, and I don't see it as making things silly if you get rid of a lot of these arcane academic debates and instead replace them with more substantive, actionable information. And in that regard, there is nothing wrong with these children's books for adults, because they manage to communicate those ideas quite efficiently. I mean, it's a few pages and it's got a lot of pictures in it, but you will get the idea of what the price mechanism does if you read The Story of the Pencil, or you will get the idea of the problems of central banking if you read the story of The Creature from Jekyll Island, without having to go through hundreds of pages or thousands of pages of Mises going through the history and the meticulous details, which, let's face it, most people don't have the time for it. But I think that, you know, you don't have to be a black belt in Mises in order to understand that central banking is bad. And I think it's when I was writing my latest book, Principles of Economics, the kind of one of the driving forces in my mind was to always resist the temptation to get into too much of a slugging match with the mainstream. Like for me, the idea that I've managed to build my own readership outside of academia, this is what's so liberating about it, is that I know I have a readership. I know I have people who like to read my work, and I'm just writing for them to communicate the idea. I don't need to get into a slugging match with Krugman. I don't need to go into, arguing with Krugman's latest column in the New York Times said this, and here's why he's wrong. Here's 300 pages explaining why this is wrong. Doesn't matter. I think at some point we need to just move beyond this stuff and just focus on communicating those ideas. And in that regard, I think the Total Twins are great for adults and kids because it gets to the heart of the idea. There's no prizes for memorizing most quotes from Mises, although it does seem like it. At least you get the long.
You wouldn't know it from the libertarians on Twitter, right?
Yeah. I mean, I must say, like, I appreciate it. I definitely appreciate the quote for truth from Mises and all these people that are hitting you with giant screenshots. Special mention out to Konza, who we've had on the podcast here. I don't know if you've seen him. He's always out there. Konza, the chairman of the Libertarian Party in Australia, I think. And he's always out there putting great quotes from Mises. It's great, but I think that works for its audience. But I think the Tuttle Twins also works great for its audience.
Well, to me, it's there's an equivalent. So my day job is I run a think tank, a nonprofit that works on legal reform in our state of Utah, but then across the United States as well. And I've been doing this for about 11 years. And traditionally, in decades past, in a think tank, you would publish white papers. You would do scholarly and academic research. You would dig into the data. You would write 50-page white papers. 8 people would read them after they were published, and you would move on to the next one. Just a very inefficient use of resources. And frankly, I think it just boils down to the fact that I'm impatient. I don't want to wait 40 years for someone to hopefully read one of these white papers and take action on it. I want action now. I want to change things now. I want to make a big splash. And so when we started, I specifically kind of rejected that model. And we don't do any white papers. We don't do any like in-depth scholarly analysis. That's not to say it doesn't have its place. We need the data to back up our arguments. We need people out there doing that. That's just not for me, because I'm trying to reach and persuade the masses. I'm trying to change hearts, minds, and laws. And so consequently, we've optimized a lot for, you know, like we have this quote kind of internally in our organization. There's the WWJD, which, you know, for years was trendy to have on your bracelets or whatever. What would Jesus do, right, for Christians to kind of think of? Our acronym is WWMBD, which stands for What Would Mr. Beast Do? Because if you've ever watched a Mr. Beast video, in the first 5 seconds, he's captivated your attention and you're hooked to see where the story goes. And so we think a lot about when writing our articles or doing our videos or whatever content that we're putting out, always trying to think through, look, people are very distracted. They've got, you know, stimuli coming from all corners, and suddenly they're now seeing your article, your video, your tweet, your whatever. How can you preserve that attention and then maintain it over a period of time where you can have the chance to inform them and educate them about something? So always just trying to think through, how do we optimize for limited attention? And I'll tell you, 60-page storybooks that are full of illustrations, you know, are a great way to do that. Because like you, it's like, hey, it's bedtime. Let's read a book. This will take 20 minutes, you know, but it's something valuable other than these fluffy stories that are in all these random other books. And so producing our information, disseminating our ideas in snackable little quantities and sizes, I feel like it's a lot of seed planting. Who knows what your kids or my kids or kids reading the Tuttle Twins are going to grow up to do 20, 30, 50 years from now, if we plant all these seeds from a younger age that are going to, you know, nurture and mature over time. So I'm a big believer that if we want to communicate our ideas, we have to speak the language of our audience. And Rothbard and Mises and Hayek, and, you know, unfortunately, as great as their ideas are, that's just not the language of today's audience. One thing that I'm excited to experiment with is, in fact, I was going to talk to the Mises Institute folks guys about this. Imagine training an AI on all of Mises' works, right? And so it masters, here's what Mises said and believed and wrote and every book, every essay, everything. And then you say, great, now explain to me praxeology like I'm a high school senior, right? Or write a story about human action from the perspective of a little kid's lemonade stand. Right. And we can access the wisdom of all these people, but framing it in different narratives and stories and learning levels. And so I don't think we need to write off, not that I'm saying you were advocating this, but I don't think we need to write off these economists of the past and the specific audiences that we were writing about. I think we can actually leverage them using tools like AI, and we can actually access their ideas and make them more accessible to kids at a younger age. So I'm excited to kind of experiment with that. Frankly, even for myself, I think it would unlock a lot more of these economists' ideas than is even accessible to me.
Oh, absolutely. I think reading these short stories can help me understand those ideas better, in the sense of, you know, in my mind, these ideas are just very sophisticated thought processes where if you're trying to explain them, you know, you need to go through a whole 40-minute lecture to try and explain them. And then these books help me get to the essence of what this is important. So I very much agree with you. Just a little context for some of our listeners. Mr. Beast is, I'm not very familiar with him, but I hear the name. He's some extremely viral content creator on the internet who's extremely, extremely popular and manages to get a lot of people's attention. Yeah. And I think it's a good hero to have in these times, because you're trying to get these ideas out there. And I think it's amazing if you have kids today, just how much out there is a propaganda. You know, we walk into a kid's bookshop, pick up an innocuous looking book with, you know, a nice little boy on the cover, and then you take it home and you try to read it to your kids, and it's all about how humans are destroying the earth because we are, you know, burning fuels that keep us warm through the winter, and we're all evil, and this kid is going to save the world by, you know, inventing some technology that teaches you to have fun staying cold and poor and not using energy, and just basically glorifying glorifying getting away from industrialization, getting away from production, getting away from improving human life, and back to this extremely, extremely nefarious way of looking at the world, wherein you as a child, you know, your ultimate duty is just not exist and to not have any impact on earth. You're not here to make the world better. You're not here to work, to produce, to make the lives of other people better. You're here to destroy the things that people are doing to make their lives better, you know, because somehow, apparently, you know, producing carbon dioxide, which all of us do at every minute in which we are alive, that somehow is cooking the earth and changing the weather. And the only way around fixing that is for us to essentially give up the last 1,000 years of industrialization and go back, you know, to 30-year life expectancies, and making every winter an ordeal and making survival very uncertain. This is enormously, enormously common in children's literature these days. It's almost impossible to go to a children's museum that is not at this point fixated on this insane cult. Like, it's everywhere you go. You go to a children's museum, you think, all right, well, you know, maybe we'll go and give some nice ideas to the kids. And it's all about, you know, you are guilty because you're breathing, and because you get into a car, and because you are driving around, you're ruining the planet.
Or that you exist, right? Because now it's like you should have fewer children because there are attacks on the resources of the planet, and there's all this scarcity. So even human life itself.
Exactly. And it's so nefarious, and it's so pervasive. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. I mean, I think it's pretty sad that normal people like you and me aren't producing a lot more children's literature, because if you go to a children's bookshop or if you go to a children's museum, this is the dominant ideology. I mean, it's all about, to the extent that there is any kind of reference to economics, it's all about how we are evil, we're ruining the earth, and kill yourself. The one conclusion you can come out to this is you should probably kill yourself to make the earth better. And I think that helps explain a lot of the mental illnesses you see in young kids. And I think there's been research. I don't have the research handy on me right now, but there's been a lot of research that shows a lot of the depression in teenagers and in young adults is intertwined with belief in the moronic carbon dioxide apocalypse, wherein kids have had this beaten into them since the age of 4 or 5, that, you know, the earth is dying, and it's all because of you and because of your consumption, because you got into a car, because you have a TV, because you have all these electronics, you're killing earth. And not enough is being done to offer an alternative perspective. To an extent, religious education serves as a good counter to that. But in many cases, religion education itself is being subverted to spread this message. So we see that as well.
I'll try and pull in an economist reference here. I think of Bastiat when he talks about that which is seen and that which is unseen. And I think for a lot of parents, what is seen is the, you know, kids' books that they buy at home or the programming on the TV or on their phone that they know that their children are watching. But there's a lot of what's unseen that parents are simply not aware that their children are being exposed to. And, you know, those kids are getting it from their peers. They're getting it from social media. They're getting it at school. And so what I see from my perch is a lot of parents who are shocked when they find out what their children have been exposed to in prior years, or when they really don't see kind of that, you know, that what's unseen is like these tiny little seeds being planted by those who espouse this ideology. And maybe the parents dismiss it as like, oh, you know, whatever, you know, it's someone claiming that big whoop. But for that child, right, that message is a seed that gets firmly embedded in their mind and, you know, starts to warp or change their worldview in the future. And so the parents don't realize that even though these tiny little seeds being planted from their perspective are inconsequential or not that big a deal, the cumulative aggregate effect or the effect over time is far more significant. I can't tell you how many parents I hear from who are frustrated because they wake up one day and their children are, you know, yeah, totally believing in this kind of eco cult of self-flagellation. And they're like, where did we go wrong? We never, you know, we taught our kids the opposite. And they have not been aware. Like I tell parents, I say, you will lose every battle that you don't know is even being fought. Like a big message that I'm espousing right now is that we're in a mind war. We're in the midst of significant psychological warfare where us, but certainly our children, are being bombarded with messages. And if you don't realize that this is warfare, you know, you're not going to be equipping your child with armor. You're not going to be equipping them with a weapon. They're not going to know who the enemy is, how that enemy is trying to attack them, how they can defend themselves from that enemy, how they can fight back against that enemy. They're not going to know any of that if you're just like, la, 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 we're just going through life and everything's peachy and everything will be okay. And I don't love to like use the terms of warfare to try and like overhype or cause fear with what's happening. But I do believe that the effect of what we're seeing is tantamount to psychological warfare, that there are people who recognize, frankly, like we do, that if you want to shift public perception and attitudes, you have to go after the children. This is what, frankly, dictators have done, you know, throughout time immemorial, is they've always gone after whether, you know, Lenin, Stalin, Castro, Mao, Hitler, all these guys, they always went after youth education because they recognized what Horace Mann said. Horace Mann was the first Secretary of Education in the United States, founder of kind of the common school, basically the proto-public school. He was an early pioneer of today's government schools. And he has this quote where he says, men are like cast iron, children are like wax, right? In other words, children are so much more manipulable and you can shape them into whatever image that you want. Those adults, nah, they're cast iron. They're too inflexible. You know, Hitler has this quote in 1933. I'll butcher it because I don't have it prepared here. But he basically says, you know, when critics tell me, you know, I'll never come to your side, I'll respond. I'll respond to you and say, who are you? In a few years, you'll pass away. Your child will know nothing but this new camp he is standing in. Right. And so we have to recognize, I think, that there are people out there who have wildly different ideologies and belief systems and worldviews than we do. They are trying to come after our children. I think it is tantamount to psychological warfare, the means and methods that they're using to do so. And so we have to defend ourselves. We have to defend our children from becoming victims in this mind war. And too many parents, too many liberty-minded, you know, free market type parents, they assume the best. They think, things will be okay. I went to public school. I turned out fine, you know, and they just kind of have blinders on and don't realize the gravity of the situation that we're in. So a lot of my effort, I feel like, is trying to wake those parents up and red pill them and say, put some armor on your kid, give them a weapon, tell them who the enemy is, because they're out there and we need to defend ourselves.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Absolutely. There's an Arabic saying that says, Al-ilmu fi al-saghari kan-naqshi fi al-hajari, which means teaching youth is like sculpting or carving stone. Because I think it's very true, because like it's very easy to carve children into the shape, and then they take that shape, and then it's stuck for life, and it's very difficult for people to break out of habits as well as mental frameworks once they have been inculcated with them since youth. So it's extremely important. You know, there's this author, James Clear, who wrote this great book, Atomic Habits. He has this chart where he shows you the difference between 1.01 or 1% improvement every day compounded over a year versus 1% decline every day compounded over a year. So if you get 1% better every day, you start off at 1. By the end of the year, you're at 37.07, I think. And then if you're getting 1% worse every day, at the end of the year, you're at 0.03. And so the difference between the two is 100-fold. It's a tiny, tiny imperceptible difference initially. You know, the difference between 0.99 versus 1.01, it seems imperceptible. And for the 5-year-old, for the 7-year-old, you know, that looks like it's a very inconsequential thing. You know, just let them watch whatever is on YouTube or whatever is on TV. Let them go along with whatever their friends are watching or their friends are reading, but it adds up. You know, you plant that seed in day one, and the seed takes them in that direction wherein, you know, we're living in this environmental catastrophe and I am responsible for it. You teach them that at age 5, and then it's just going to continue to exacerbate, and it's going to just continue to grow and grow and grow. And by the age of 20, you're going to have somebody who's effectively mentally neutered and a mental prisoner who just can't think of taking charge of their life, who can't think of taking action about anything because they have been essentially conditioned to imagine that they can't do anything, they shouldn't do anything, they are evil, they are bad. And whereas on the other hand, if you teach them to take charge of their life, if you teach them to take action, if you teach them that, you know, it's your duty and responsibility and calling, and this is why you're on earth and you need to take charge of your life, you need to do things. Well, then by the age of 20, you're going to have a highly productive and highly action-oriented individual that's looking forward to living their life and being the best that they can.
I think that's right. For a lot of parents, I think it boils down to intentionality, kind of like being proactive versus reactive. I think too many parents are reactive to what's happening. They're deferring to teachers. They're assuming that the textbook, you know, creators are all wise and knowing. And they're just very reactive to what is happening in society. They're acted upon by others rather than acting of their own accord and saying, I'm going to be proactive. I'm going to determine what I want my children to learn. I'm going to try and assess the psychological or intellectual or ideological concerns or threats out there in society. And I'll tell you, like, I think it just boils down to the fact that too many parents feel like they don't understand these ideas well enough and they have no clue how to simplify them. I mean, even, you know, your own concession earlier where here, this is your profession and your whole world. And yet it's hard. I mean, it was hard for me writing the books to figure out how do you take a concept like spontaneous order, you know, and explain that to a 5-year-old. And so it is tough. My whole goal and desire is to say, like, can we empower those parents to feel a little bit more confident so that they start talking to their kids about these ideas at an even earlier age. You look at the polls across the world, but certainly here in the United States, where I'm from as well, and you see the rising generation increasingly supporting socialism and despising capitalism, and it's manifested across a variety of polls that all indicate this trend. And to me, it's this byproduct of socialists, a socialist school system that is, you know, teaching kids that socialism is okay. And maybe they're not using those precise words, but it's infused in all the curriculum and all the activities and the very structure of these schools itself. It boils down for me to this. I am sick of playing defense. I feel like so much of our work out there is defensive, even like a think tank like mine and so many others where we're trying to change the laws or we're trying to file lawsuits and protect our rights. These are all important things. We've got to be engaged in that fight. But I feel like it's all defense because we're reacting to and being acted upon by others who are shaping the narrative and driving the agenda. And we're just trying to slow them down a little bit. For every, you know, 8 steps in their direction, we get excited when we take 1 step back in our direction. And we've been doing this for decades. And the liberty movement has just been, I think, derelict in the sense that we've delegated the intellectual development of our children during their most formative years to our ideological opponents who dominate these school systems. And then we get surprised, you know, when they all of a sudden turn out to be, you know, these like raging social justice warriors or eco-terrorists and the like, right? And so I think that we need to go on the offense. I think that we need to stop being reactive to other people shaping the narrative. For too long, we have sucked at narrative building, at shaping culture, at trying to influence people's behavior. The so-called left, the statists have dominated all the industries and all the levers of influence in our society. And I don't think that that's a given. I don't think that that's like inherent in the way that society is structured. I think we've just been asleep at the wheel for too long. And those of us who believe in freedom or free markets or liberty or whatever you want to call it have just been focused on our businesses and our families, and rightly so. But we've disengaged from these broader societal efforts to shape the future generation. Meanwhile, the activists are over here like very intentionally focused on this. And we've lost. We've ceded a ton of ground. It'll be hard for us to reclaim that ground. I think it's possible. But it's going to take a lot of like concerted effort. I think it's going to take a lot of coalition building and coordinated effort, which we also suck at because it's like cat herding, right? Trying to get libertarians and others to work together broadly in coalitions and shared movements. Everyone's such a rugged individualist that they just want to forge their own path. But I get as pessimistic as I can get about our society and the economy and the future and all these problems that we're going to have in the next years and decades. I am optimistic when I think about how many seeds we're planting. And like for me as an individual, I was heavily influenced by Ron Paul when he was running for the presidential race in 2007. I came across him in 2006. I Googled Ron Paul. I started watching and reading all these speeches. He recommended all these books by Austrian economists and historians. So I went down the rabbit hole, and that's how I kind of got introduced into this world. Well, Ron Paul was that one influence. I interviewed him on our podcast a year or two ago, and I reminded him after his 2012 race, when he was winding things down, you know, and things were, the Ron Paul revolution was wrapping up. A lot of these young people who were following him asked him, like, what's next? What do we do next? You know, where do we go? What's the next step of the revolution? And he would tell them, like, I don't know. You know, like you figure that out. And so I reminded him of that on the podcast interview. And he said, Connor, you're exactly like an indication of this. I never would have thought to tell anyone, go write children's books, right? I never would have thought to tell people, go start a think tank or whatever. And so because of his influence, one person, I'm now impacting, and my partner and our whole team through our Tuttle Twins work, we're impacting millions of kids. Well, who's the future Ron Paul, right, for the next generation, that had we not planted that seed right now, had we not reached them early on, they would have gone on some other, you know, trajectory in life or whatever, and we would have missed out on their influence and impact, you know, for the next generation. And so I see a lot of what I'm trying to do is just planting those seeds, because I don't know who that person is going to be, but I know they're out there, and I hope 1,000 of them are out there, because the earlier and the more meaningfully we get at them from a younger age and help their parents support them down this path, that makes me optimistic. With all the pessimism I have, I get really excited when I think of, man, you know, who are we supporting that's going to be like amazing in the future and help us fix this mess?
Yeah, absolutely. This is another example of the concept of spontaneous order. We don't know how these things are going to pan out, but when you orient your action in the direction that you believe is the correct one, good things happen long term down the line. You just need to start sowing the seeds. I think this is really the key thing. It's a long game, and you really are playing the long game. So I wanted to ask you, tell us a little bit about how you got started. Perhaps this might inspire people. So how did the idea get to you? When did you decide that this was going to be what you were going to be working on?
So the think tank that I mentioned, I started that in 2011. And a few years into it, we had had some limited success. We had changed a couple of laws. My children at the time were 5 and 3. I have a boy and a girl. And I would come home at the end of the day and, I would ask the kids, hey, what did you do today? And the answer typically was I played with my toys or I, watched this cartoon or whatever. But my 5-year-old, he was almost 6. He started to reciprocate the question. Dad, what did you do today? I didn't want to just say I typed on a computer or I made phone calls. Like, I wanted to meaningfully respond to him. But how do you tell a 6-year-old or a 5-year-old that you are fighting eminent domain at, City Hall when they're trying to steal someone's property? Like, how do you boil that down? How do you tell them you're trying to like stop this socialist program? So I literally went to Amazon and I searched for, libertarian books for kids or teach free markets to kids or, all these different things. And I couldn't find anything. This was 2013, coming on 2014. And I was talking at the time with a buddy of mine who was also big in the Ron Paul presidential campaign. He had produced a bunch of videos for the campaign. And he and I had known one another. His name's Elijah, and he's our illustrator. He and I had known one another for a few years, and we sensed in one another this kind of like simpatico, vibe, like, hey, we should do something together. Like, you've got skills, I've got skills, let's figure out what that is. So he was thinking about this too. What would it be like to take some of these classic books and turn them into children's versions? So we got together and we said, all right, we have no idea if this idea has any merit. We have no idea if it's going to go anywhere. So if this flops and we only produce one book, what should that book be? And the idea that we had was that for our children's books, every book would be based off of or inspired by, a classic or important text. So for both of us, The Law by Frederick Bastiat was hugely influential in our own kind of red pill awakening into the ideas of freedom. And so we decided that that would be the book that we would do. So it became The Tuttle Twins Learn About the Law, where kids learn about, natural rights and justice and proper role of government and all that kind of stuff from Bastiat's perspective. And we launched the book in 2014 at Freedom Fest, which is a libertarian conference typically in Las Vegas, but now they do it around the United States. This year, I think it's in Memphis, Tennessee. So it's a big libertarian gathering. And I had a booth there. We were in the corner of the vendor hall because no one knows who we are. I had hardly any money. I got the cheap seats out in the nosebleed section. Hardly anyone's walking by, And if you ever watch Shark Tank, which I watch religiously, I really enjoy Shark Tank. For those who don't know, Shark Tank is a show where companies can try and get investment from investors on the show. And one of the biggest challenges that people have when they pitch the sharks trying to get investment is if they're a category creator. In other words, if they've created some totally new novel concept or product and the sharks resist that because they're saying not only do you have to try and acquire a customer and get them to buy your product, you have to educate them in the first place about why they even need something like this because they're not familiar with it. And they never really like to invest in those companies. Well, we were a category creator in 2014. No one was educating kids about these ideas. Today, you've got a lot of other books and folks that are teaching kind of conservative or libertarian type ideas to kids, but no one was doing it. So I'm sitting at the booth, hardly anyone is walking by. I had just published, I think a week or two prior, our website where we were selling online at tuttletwins.com. And so I was getting little email notifications when we would get an order. I'm behind my booth in Las Vegas, dark corner of the room. I get a notification on my phone. Someone bought 50 copies of the book. And I was like, you know, like, wow, who is this? I scroll down and it's Carol Paul, the wife of Ron Paul, who was buying a copy for all of their grandchildren. And I was like, oh, we've made it. You know, the grandfather of the Liberty Movement has endorsed and validated this project. And so since that, like that was the time when I'm like, I think we're onto something. I think this could be something big. And so now we've got 13 books in the children's series. We've got 6 toddler books. We've got, I don't know, like 8 or 9 books for teenagers. I've come out with a couple of American history books as well. And just trying to produce a ton of content for kids of all ages. You know, we've got the cartoon. I know you interviewed Daniel Harmon before, who's our showrunner for the cartoon. We've got a podcast. We've got a game. We're trying to create a content empire so that we can reach kids of all ages in a variety of different learning methods so that these ideas really kind of sink in.
That's very nice. And so how long has it taken you to write the 12 books? You've got 12 books out now, right?
For the children's series, we now have 13. The most recent book, the 13th book, is based off of 12 Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson. So we teach his 12 Rules Simplified. That one came out last year. So it's been, gosh, almost a decade, 9 years that we've done these 13 books plus all the teen and toddler books. I think total we have like 25 or 26 books that we've done now.
Nice. Are you planning on keeping churning out more books, or what do you think?
Originally, the vision, which I hesitate to even call it that, because I think it was a very blurry vision that we had early on. But the idea that we started with was we'll do like 8 or 9 or 10 books, and then we'll be done. We'll create like a boxed set, you know, that you kids can get for Christmas or whatever, and it'll have some finality to it. So we got done with our 8th book. And we sent a survey out to, and this was, I don't know, 2018 or 19. We sent a survey out to all of our customers and we said, hey, we've always kind of planned on wrapping this up, but we're open to the idea of keeping going. We just don't really know what the market wants. What do you guys say? And it was something like 88% of people said, do more books, keep going. And so we've got no plans to stop right now. We've got a long list of other, you know, books and topics that we haven't covered yet that we want to be able to do. We're branching out into the other ages. We're even thinking of a books for parents that just like simplify a lot of these ideas, but more nonfiction style to help educate them. So we've got no shortage of ideas and frankly demand from our community. So as fatiguing as it is to think that this has no end in sight, it's such gratifying work to get those little dopamine hits of stories and gratitude from parents who are seeing these aha moments. Like quick story that I like sharing that happened recently. Dad was walking down the grocery store aisle, down the chip aisle, all the different potato chips and so forth. And his 9-year-old daughter was with him. And he's walking down the aisle and she's no longer by his side. He turns back, walks back towards where she is, and she's just staring at these chips. Dad says, you know, what are you doing? And she says, Dad, I get it now. I get spontaneous order. There's no like president in charge of potato chips, and yet there's curly and wavy and baked and sour cream and onion and all these kinds. There's nobody in charge, and yet we have all of like these choices. And the dad emails me this story, and he's just like, it was something like I was bursting inside of just being giddy at like seeing my daughter get it. And as great as that is to have that single light bulb moment, that's a huge kind of mental shift that then has this cascade effect on other, you know, thoughts and choices and what she's going to read and find curious and so forth. Those stories, when I get them, are extremely motivating. Like, oh man, I got to keep this going. We got to keep reaching and teaching more kids. And so we spend millions of dollars a year in advertising. We're very kind of aggressive in the sense that we're making a concerted effort to try and reach and influence as many people as possible to get them to buy the books and then learn. Because for us, it's a very mission-driven thing. We structure all of this through a nonprofit, an NGO. And so we basically recycle the sales revenue back into marketing so that hopefully it's like a snowball going down the hill that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and we can reach more people over time.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, you knew this question was coming, but when are we going to see a Bitcoin book?
I'm shocked at a question like this. So what a lot of people may not realize is, so I've got here a copy of the Tuttle Twins and the Creature from Jekyll Island. And this was in 2015, I think. Yeah, 2015 that we wrote this. Quick segue. Let's see. I first heard about Bitcoin in late 2012. And then I think it was in 2013, I was part of a team that produced a film. Did you ever see this or hear of this called Life on Bitcoin?
I think so. I think I've heard about it.
It was a newlywed couple who a film crew followed them right after they got married and went on their honeymoon. They had to surrender their wallets, their phones, and they had to go live for 90 days only on Bitcoin. This was back in 2013 when, you know, hardly anyone knew about it. And so they had to figure out how to get home from the airport using only Bitcoin. They had to negotiate with their landlord to compensate him, to get him to accept Bitcoin. They had to go to find a gas station who would accept Bitcoin. And like nobody was at the time. So the idea behind the project was not only is the film crew watching them ask the landlord, but you're watching Austin and his wife, Becky, you're watching them teach the landlord what Bitcoin is, how it works, why it's important. And so I was part of that project back in 2013. So in 2015, when we wrote this book, at the end, when we're talking about like alternatives and stuff, we included Bitcoin as one of the alternatives, and we've got a little wallet right there. So that was, 8 years ago that we did that one. I have in mind, though, to do a more specific book about Bitcoin. And I'll tell you, I recommend your book, Bitcoin Standard, widely, because I do find that for adults, it's far more accessible than any of the, just the first half of the book, talking all about hard money versus soft money before even getting into Bitcoin. I find it to be such a helpful analysis for adults. And one of the things that you wrote about, you retweeted this weeks ago when I posted this on Twitter, so perhaps you'll remember this, but one of the portions of your book that most impacted me or gave me a new insight was the effect on the family of hard money versus soft money. And that when you have soft money, people are not investing in their future and in their posterity, but their you know, time preference is being shortened, and they're spending all their money now. And so future generations are becoming dependent on the state and so forth. Whereas, you know, in a society of hard money, you have a lot more intergenerational, you know, structure, cohesiveness, investment. And so that's the angle that I'm kind of noodling around right now for a potential book, is like the broader, you talk about like architecture and all these things, right? Looking at hard money, like some of those insights that you've shared that I think it would be better for us to do a book about hard money and soft money, maybe kind of an expansion on the Creature from Jekyll Island, while also talking about, you know, Bitcoin. And I don't know that we'll do a book just on Bitcoin, but I think Bitcoin can play a central role in saying, like, here's why hard money is so important. As we see society collapsing and crumbling as a result of soft money, what's the solution to that? It's hard money. Okay, great. What's hard money? Let's talk through the options. Hey, here's Bitcoin. That's something that's of deep interest to me, because I think the ramifications are huge. And I think a lot of people, I didn't even think about the impact on the family as a result of, you know, a soft money society. It was very fascinating for me and something I'd love to explore even more.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm delighted to hear that. And I hope it does come to fruition. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we had Daniel Harmon, who's done the cartoon series, the animated series, and they'd done an episode on Bitcoin, which I'm sure you've seen. And it exactly follows that path. It was a great attack to, it was a great approach to the issue, which is compare the idea of easy money versus hard money. I think it's extremely intuitive, and the way they did it was extremely approachable for children. And I remember discussing it with my daughter. It was the one time that I felt that I could communicate the ideas in my work with her. Like, because before that, I mean, she knew we had all these big books at the house that Daddy made those books, but like, what is the book about, Daddy? I'm like, well, you know, there's this guy called Satoshi.
How much time do you have to talk about this?
Exactly. But, you know, there's this, when the money, monetary energy that gets stored, and then when they make more of the rubies, the value of their monetary energy declines. I think that is quite intuitive for children. And it's a lesson that once you learn, you can't unlearn. Once you see this, you will never unsee it. You will always understand it. Like, there's basically nobody who disagrees with this. There's no coherent disagreement that can tell you, no, actually, you're better off living in a place where your money is constantly losing value. Obviously, you know, Keynesian government employees will come up with sophisticated rationales. But even then, you know, their rationales depend on the fiction that their money is, their soft money is only inflating at around 2-3% per year. And so even they, you know, even the most brainwashed Keynesian will tell you that if it goes beyond 2-3%, then it becomes a bit of a problem. And obviously, you know, the only way you believe it actually is 2-3% is if you are extremely gullible to the point where you think the CPI means anything. Whereas in reality, obviously, you know, the money supply is increasing at a much faster rate. And so therefore, the CPI is completely meaningless as a metric. And, you know, we've discussed this many times. I discussed it in the Bitcoin standard and in the fiat standard. Ultimately, the problem with the CPI is that you're measuring what people purchase, but what people purchase depends on the value of their money. And so when the value of my money declines, I can't just keep paying more for more expensive things that will show the true magnitude of inflation. I'm going to have to substitute away from the things that I would have bought into cheaper, inferior things that are harder to, that are cheaper, that are affordable to me. And so the value of the things that I'm buying remains the same. You know, if my income is $100, it doesn't matter what happens to the value of the dollar. I can only spend $100. That's all that I can spend. So the CPI is going to massively understate inflation just because it's measuring what people are spending, and what people are spending depends on what they earn rather than what is happening to the value of money. It's amazing when you explain these things to children, it becomes much more straightforward than when you're trying to discuss it with Keynesians, because I mean, children are more intelligent than Keynesians.
I would concur with that, and I'm gratified to hear that the Bitcoin cartoon episode was useful even in your own family, because when we were in the writing room working on that episode, and I think Daniel talked about this in your interview, like, it was very difficult to figure out how to simplify this and explain it for kids. You know, we've talked about a lot of issues on the cartoon and certainly in the books as well. But this one was tough. It took us quite a bit of time to figure out, like, okay, how do you, exactly like you said, like, when you see something, you can't unsee it. And how do you plant that seed or share that analogy, or what's the metaphor that's going to best, like, help a kid be like, aha, I understand what this means. Took a lot of effort, but it's been awesome. Like, that, I think, is the episode that's done the best out of any of them so far. You know, you shared it and Sailor shared it. We're trying to get Elon Musk still to share it. We threw him in with the Doge in there launching into space. So we're trying to, that was a shameless attempt just to try and get him to retweet the cartoon when it launched. So we're still working on that, but
I think he just needs to watch it. I'd be happy with him just watching it. I think he'd stand to learn a lot of lessons from it. I think his fascination with Doge shows that he's still at the stage where he needs to get the difference between easy and hard money, unfortunately.
It was a fun episode though. And so what I'm trying to explore, what I often think about is, like, we'll use this as an example. Once a child understands that creating more money devalues, you know, the existing money supply, as you say, that's a lesson that can't be unlearned. And one, I think, that has broader ramifications for a whole host of things in the future if they understand that simple idea and the concept of, you know, hard money versus soft money. And so a lot of what we spend our time in, both with the books, but also with the cartoon, it's what are those simple little nuggets? What are the concepts or the values or the ideas that if we turned it into a fun little jingle for kids to remember, or if it's part of a fun story in the book, that's going to have like a deep and long lasting recollection, retention, application as that kid gets older. Because as fun as it is to produce a cartoon or to write a book, like, ultimately what we're after is lasting change, and helping people develop these worldviews based on truth. And so a lot of it's like, what are those high leverage little nuggets or concepts, that we can do?
Well, that's fantastic. Fantastic. I mean, I wish you guys all the best of luck on everything that you're doing. You're making my job parenting my kids a lot easier. So I strongly commend you for that.
Mission accomplished.
Well, very far from accomplished, but at least, you know, I can
mission
see
in progress.
Yeah, I can see a direction in which we can head, and, you know, some vague sense of a destination to arrive at, as opposed to before that when it was really, you know, hopefully it was just teach them to read, and then when they're adults, we can hit them with a Rothbard 1,000 pages and see how that works out.
Well, I think it's super important that parents be more intentional with this and not wait. As you just said, like, we'll wait until the children are adults. Like, if I had an invitation or a call to action, it would be that your kids are never too young to start to learn these ideas, even in their most simplest or basic form. I think my job as a parent is to teach my children how the world works, our worldview, to the extent that I believe certain principles or beliefs that I have are true. And to share that, it's so odd. Parents who are, let's say, you know, a lot of our community is Christian, and they'll take their children to Bible study, or to Sunday school, and they have no second thought about transmitting their religious value system to their children and intentionally and systematically and really putting in that effort to transmit those religious ideas. And yet so few parents, from my experience over the last decade, bring that same level of intentionality to their economic or, you know, political ideas. And they don't really, and maybe it's because they're not firmly rooted in any concept of truth in those areas, and they don't understand them. Therefore they don't prioritize teaching them. But I think a lot of parents, even in the liberty movement, the Austrian economic world, do believe that they understand this set of true ideas, and yet they don't bring that same effort to transmitting those ideas when they're kids. So whether it's Tuttle Twins or doing it on your own or something else, like, my invitation to parents is talk to your kids about how the world works, even at a young age, that your dinner discussions are going to be far more meaningful. You're going to help your children understand their place in the world, I think, a lot better than just having those blinders on. You're going to develop critical thinking, which I think is an essential quality that so many kids are lacking today. They're going to be skeptical of authority, which I always tell parents, be careful teaching your children about, you know, truth and logical. Like, we have this whole book called The Guide to Logical Fallacies for Teens. And when we published the book, I warned parents. I said, if you get this book for your kids, they're going to understand how to pick apart fallacies in debates and discussions, including your own, that they're going to see, like, oh, mom, you're, you know, what you're saying right now, no, that's the, you know, straw man or whatever, right? But I think it's important that we do this with our kids, because if we don't, frankly, I think we see all around us the effect of what happens when we don't. And we see this highly ignorant society of just being led along like sheep by these authoritarian, you know, thugs who are just doing what they want. That's not what I want for my future. It's not what I want for my kids' future. So I think collectively we have to go on the offense. We have to stop playing defense. We have to stop assuming the best of intentions from school teachers and textbooks and, you know, social media and everything else. We need to recognize it is a psychological war. There are people that are trying to indoctrinate our children. So we got to fight back. And hopefully the Tuttle Twins can be a tool or some armor in that effort to protect our kids and teach them the truth.
Absolutely. Connor, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have anything else to add?
No, just for those who are interested, TuttleTwins.com is where you can get all the books. As I said, have from toddler age to teens. So no matter the age of your child or grandchild, or if, you know, you don't have kids and you just want to learn these things better yourself, then you can get them for yourself. But TuttleTwins.com is where all the books are at. Oh, and for your listeners, make sure you use the coupon code SAIF, S-A-I-F, when you're at TuttleTwins.com. That's going to get you 40% off of the children's book bundle, all 13 books. And then we also throw in all 13 activity workbooks. So you get a bundle for a screaming deal. Enter SAIF SAFE as your coupon during checkout, and then you get 40% off.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Connor. I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate everything that you're doing. And I wish you guys all the best of luck.
Likewise. Keep it up. Thank you.
Cheers. Take care.